This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, and today for Catherine Cruz. When the Board of Water Supply spelled out its desire to tear down the Haiku Stairs this past Sunday, it seemed like the popular hiking trail would be doomed. But then Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell proposed that the board transfer jurisdiction of the so-called Stairway to Heaven to the city's Department of Parks and Recreation. Mayor Caldwell spoke to Hawaii Public Radio about his hopes to keep and maintain the Haiku Stairs under considerable county regulations.
I think it's a great asset that should be made available to the people of the city and county of Honolulu and visitors when they come here in some managed way with managed access. And that's the big hurdle, is how do we set up that managed access and how do we manage those folks going up there and make sure they're safe? Because if firefighters have to go and do rescues, it puts their lives in jeopardy too, in a fairly dangerous situation, very steep stairs with a lot of different types of winds that blow around. But first step is complete the final EIS, then get the property transferred to Department of Parks and Rec. I've talked to Department of Parks and Rec. They have agreed to take the transfer from the Board of Water Supply. And that requires working with the neighborhoods where the access would be made available, and working with the council member from that neighborhood, Cherry Kaika Anderson, and of course the community. We go to the neighborhood boards. But I think there is a way to do this. It's a valuable asset. I think people should have access to all of our beaches, and they should have access to our mountains, and we're going to work in that direction.
The mayor's not the only one who wants to keep the stairs intact. Vernon Ansdell, president of the Friends of Haiku Volunteer Organization, agrees with that idea. He likes the prospect of the trail being brought under control of the city and county, regulations and all. In addition to maintaining the stairs for public use, Ansdell also said oversight is needed to address concerns of nearby residents. They believe the hiking trail's drawn more visitors than their windward infrastructure can support. Ansdell reached out to HPR to voice his hope for ongoing dialogue between the city and county and volunteer groups regarding the future of the trail.
Our goal has always been to get the stairs reopened. That's our primary goal. Quite how it's run would be a sort of secondary consideration, if you like. We would like to be involved in an advisory role, you know, whoever is trying to do it, because we think there's some certain elements about the stairs that need to be retained, meaning we would need to have an educational program in place. And in addition, you know, you need to limit the number of people allowed to go up there. Otherwise, the stairs themselves are going to suffer. There'll be erosion around the stairs and that sort of thing. I mean, I think it'll be a challenge because you're having to alter the mindset of people from something where there was security in place, but it wasn't effective and it was pretty easy to get around. It could go up, you know, illegally. So we will need to alter the mindset so that people realize that with the security plan that we have in mind, you will not be able to get on the stairs. You will not, you know, be able to get to the summit. You might get arrested. You might have to pay a hefty fine. And at the end of the day, you will have not gone onto the stairs. I think with time, people will realize that, okay, we can't do it illegally anymore, but by getting a permit and paying a fee, we can go up there legally and enjoy the experience. So it's going to take a while to alter people's mindset, but I think it's possible.
The Board of Water Supply's chief engineer, Ernie Lau, said it was only recently that the mayor shared his view about the fate of the scenic stairway. Lau talked with The Conversation's Catherine Cruz about that hope.
We're going through the EIS process, and once the final EIS is completed, then it'll be a decision before the Board of Water Supply, the Water Board, on how we should proceed from there. In the early 2000s, when Mayor Harris was still here, they did actually invest $800,000 or $900,000 in doing some repairs to the stairs at the time. The EIS process is really a disclosure process to the community. Our proposed action is for the removal. However, we do look at a range in the draft EIS of alternatives, including no action, partial removal of some of the stair modules, or conveyance of the land to a public or private entity that will be responsible for perhaps a managed access to the stairs.
Now, the issue for the Board of Water Supply has been liability, correct?
Well, there is a liability is one issue, but the other issue is also providing the security because the stairs has been closed. Haiku stairs, this type of feature is kind of a recreational improvement to the to provide access to the mountaintop there, but it's really not in keeping with the mission, core mission of the Board of Water Supply, which is to provide safe, dependable, and affordable water service to our community now and into the future. So we expend funds to maintain the stairs as closed, but we have to deal with trespassers that have a pretty heavy impact on the immediate residential community near the bottom of the stairs.
Yes, I mean, that's been an ongoing problem for that neighborhood.
It's been something for decades, I think, a couple of decades almost.
And it does cost money to keep security up there.
Yes, it does. We are trying to reach a point where the stairs can be either removed, if it's a decision by the board to have it removed, or to have it transferred to another government agency or private entity so they can operate the stairs. But it would have to go with the land and the stairs as a package.
Right, and the idea then, there has to be some managed access.
I can only imagine what it must be to live in the immediate vicinity by the bottom of the stairs in that neighborhood that get the impact of people trying to get to the stairs at all hours of the day or night. In the EIS process, we did look at a range of alternative routes or access points, access routes that could provide legal access to the stairs. And I think we explored seven different alternative routes in the draft EIS and did have a kind of a preferred route that we thought was probably achievable, but would still have some impact on some residential residents in the area, but it reduces the number of residents actually impacted by quite a bit. So that's in the EIS.
And you'll be able to brief the community at an upcoming meeting. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we are going to be at the Kaneohe Neighborhood Board meeting, but it's July 18th. We are meeting also with other important stakeholders and landowners to let them know the draft EIS is out there. There is only a 45-day window for comment, public comment, and that period ends on August 7th. There are different ways to provide input. We tried to make it very easy. They can go to our website at boardofwatersupply.com/community/haiku-stairs and provide comment there. Or they can also go to haikustairseis.commentinput.com. And there's actually an online form that folks can just complete the form to provide their comments. They can also email comments to us at haikustairs@g70.design, and that'll help to collect the comments to the draft EIS.
And G70 is a firm that's helping you with this planning.
G70 is the consultant that we've hired to develop this EIS for us. And between my staff that are in charge of this project and our consultant team, they've worked very hard over the last 2 years to be very thorough in this EIS. To look at many different aspects of the stairs.
Now, the Board of Water Supply has been paying out, what is about $250,000 for security to stop trespassers getting access up there. And I know there's a concern about, you know, the social media and over tourism and that folks, you know, may still be getting through. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we've struggled with this over the few years that we've been responsible for the stairs because of social media. People are much more aware about the stairs, and there's a lot of people trying to get up there. We've had private security at the bottom of the stairs. In the last few years, we've actually hired special duty HPD officers to be stationed in the community impacted community, residential community, to help reduce the number of trespassers. And that has been probably the most effective for us. When trespassers see a police officer, they're either turned away or they could be cited. There's been some cases in the past of actual arrests for people that have failed to comply or obey the officer's commands. And also there have been fines for trespassing for some of the individuals that have actually made it onto the stairs and been caught trespassing, which is breaking the law. The numbers have really come down since we implemented the special duty officers, HPD officers. But just in discussions with some of the residential folks that live in that residential community, they seem to be very appreciative. It hasn't totally eliminated trespassing, but it's greatly reduced the number of trespassers through the Windward community there.
So it's a good deterrent.
There are trespassers that are very courageous and take the very much more difficult and sometimes dangerous trail from the leeward side to get up to the stairs from the leeward side instead of the windward side.
I know, and I've covered a number of stories where we've had missing hikers where folks were trying to access through another point and unfortunately disappeared or got into trouble.
Or got injured and need to get rescued by first responders, the fire department. And so that is some of the challenge of the stairs. I haven't been up the stairs myself. I probably am not in a physical condition to make it up the almost 4,000 steps up there. But from what I see on social media, and I've been told by others, that it's a very amazing views from the top of the stairs.
Well, like you said, though, really the mission of the Board of Water Supply is about water. And I know there are watershed areas up there, but certainly allowing a recreational use doesn't fit in with your mission.
It really doesn't. We should be investing our ratepayer, our customers' funds in replacing the old and deteriorating water system, helping to protect develop new water resources. That's our core mission, and we have a responsibility right now. As long as the stairs are there, not under managed access, or if they're still remaining there, to address the trespassing issue that goes on from people trying to get up there. One thing, Catherine, I want to say, if I could put a plug in here, our watershed lands, our Mauka watersheds, was really papu in the past. It was really meant, people recognized the importance of these watersheds to preserve the quantity and the quality of our drinking water supply, which really comes from the ua, the rain falling on these Mauka lands, helping to recharge our underground aquifers. But what we see is, because of, I would say, social media right now, there's a tremendous onslaught on these watershed lands that are really meant to be our source of supply for our drinking water. And that tracks into the air, brings contamination and potentially into the watersheds, alien species that could endanger our watershed. So if people are going to go up into the watershed, they got to remember to malama the aina there and be responsible and not leave their opala or even their kukai there that could contaminate and bring disease into our water or drinking water resources. So it is a challenge. Social media makes access more easy for people, but remember our watersheds are our source of supply for our drinking water.
Okay, so then we can drive our listeners to those websites. They can come out for the neighborhood board meeting to find out more. But obviously, go online and look at that EIS and see what they think. Because if they want then that area to be preserved as a recreational area and the city can take it over, whether it's the Parks Department or another entity, it sounds like you would like to get off your hands.
That's true. Just to be clear on the decision-making process, it's going to be after the final EIS is completed, it'll be the Water Board making a decision on how to proceed. If the decision involves saying they approve the transfer to the city, then that'll also involve the City Council being the final approver of the transfer of the property to the city, and as the Mayor pointed out, perhaps the Department of Parks and Recreation. To operate under managed access.
Okay, so folks have until August 7th.
Until August 7th, so please, we encourage everybody to provide their mana'o on this issue and provide comments on the draft EIS.
EIS, of course, being Environmental Impact Statement. That's Board of Water Supply Chief Engineer Ernie Lau talking with Catherine Cruz earlier this week. For links about the Environmental Impact Statement and that meeting that was mentioned, the Kaneohe Neighborhood Board meeting, July 18th, you can log on to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Public comment open now. A final decision about the fate of the stairs likely sometime next year.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Friends of the Waikiki Aquarium's Keikani o Keikai Summer Concert Series, Under the Stars at Waikiki Aquarium, now through August 8th. Tickets at eventbrite.com.
Coming Saturday, July 6th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's a night of blues-inspired originals and classics with the Chames Gang. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Amoresco.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we examine one of East Oahu's best-known geographical features, Rabbit Island. Located just off the coast of Makapu'u, the tiny islet is said to resemble a rabbit's head rising from the ocean. In the 1880s, John Adams Cummins even introduced a small colony of domesticated rabbits to its shores when he oversaw the nearby Waimanalo plantation, giving more weight to the name Rabbit Island. The rabbits, though, proved uncooperative neighbors with the island's many endangered seabirds, and 100 years after their introduction, they were eradicated to preserve the land as a key seabird breeding area. While the rabbits of Rabbit Island are no more, they live on in name, as well as in the title of a 1973 Gabby Pahinui album, Rabbit Island Music Festival, which was recorded to raise awareness for one of the island's current residents, the Sooty Tern. While Rabbit Island is the common name known to most, it also has a traditional Hawaiian name. And for today's backyard quiz, what is that Hawaiian name of Rabbit Island? You can call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting street performers turned alternative folk pop quartet Streetlight Cadence, 7 p.m. this Saturday. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
One idea that came up at this year's legislative session was a proposal to address the housing shortage on Oahu by constructing high-density residential units on state-owned land in urban Honolulu. It was put forward by State Senator Stanley Chang, who found inspiration in a similar program run by the government of Singapore. More than 80% of Singapore residents live in low-cost public housing, and surveys show that more than 90% of those occupants are happy with their units. Stanley Chang's proposal, which he called Affordable Locally Owned Homes for All, or Aloha Homes, did not win legislative approval during this year's session, but lawmakers were intrigued enough to study the idea further. Senator Chang and a delegation of state and county officials recently returned from a fact-finding trip to Singapore. He spoke with HBR's Ryan Finity about what they learned.
Several of the key elements of this model are based on what Singapore does. And Singapore probably has the world's best public housing. It's certainly up there. And what they do is they take government-owned lands, They develop them with high-density condos in mixed-use developments, very tightly integrate them with public transportation, sell 99-year leases. They do sell them at a subsidy. The proposal that we've put forward would not involve a public taxpayer subsidy, and it would also deviate from the Singapore model in a number of other ways, but the fundamental structure is borrowed from the Singapore model.
Then you and several of your fellow lawmakers just returned to Hawaii from a fact-finding trip to Singapore to kind of look at how they do things. And could you tell us why you put together that trip and what you were hoping to learn by going there?
So maybe the toughest challenge of all in the discussions about the Aloha Homes proposal last year was getting people to comprehend that it is possible to end a housing shortage through an abundant supply of high-quality public housing. And so we gave PowerPoints, we held conferences. It was a lot of explaining, answering questions. And so I thought to myself, you know, it's one thing for me to talk about it, but it's an entirely different thing for people to be able to see it, touch it, kick the tires, and understand on a much deeper level. So we organized this delegation, which just took place last month in May, and we put together a group that included five elected officials, the heads of the two state housing agencies, representatives from the city and county of Honolulu, even two folks from California, folks from the public sector, the private sector, architects, developers, planners, construction, many of the different stakeholders, including all four counties of the state of Hawaii. We went there to really understand what it is their model does and also what we can adopt and what we cannot. Obviously, we're in very different circumstances here in Hawaii as opposed to Singapore or Hong Kong. But there were a number of really critical elements that I think the whole group walked away with, one of which was the idea that it is possible for the government to furnish abundant public housing for everyone, not just the few. Another really interesting element was understanding the way that these developments are planned. So the only way that I think we can supply thousands, tens of thousands of units of public housing from now until forever without touching agricultural or conservation land, which I believe is a core value of the people of Hawaii, is to really make these developments very dense. And what we saw in Singapore and Hong Kong is that density and mixed use does not have to be scary. It does not have to be unlivable. In fact, when you have a model that emphasizes walkability, convenience, seamless integration with transit and public transportation, you get really a quality of life that is as high, if not better, than anywhere in the world. And I think that we would be very lucky if we were able to redevelop existing urban sites that the state owns with this level of density, with this quality of life. And I think future residents would really love those new homes.
You mentioned that the Singapore program relies on public subsidies to keep the units affordable. Now that you've returned, do you think that your plan, which explicitly does not have a public subsidy, is that still workable?
I think the basic model of the plan should be an unsubsidized model, because if we're talking about a housing shortage over 10 years of 65,000 units, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar subsidy if we're talking about a subsidized model. And that's just something that we cannot burden Hawaii taxpayers with all of it, at any rate. Now, having really gotten into the weeds in Singapore and having had further discussions with a lot of the stakeholders here, I think what there is room for is indirect subsidy, for example, by helping to pay for some of the infrastructure, the sewer infrastructure for these new developments. That's, of course, on top of the zero cost basis for the land. The large taxpayer outlay for the Honolulu Rail Transit System, upon which all of this is premised and without which none of these developments would be viable. And the impetus of, you know, the state not having to make a profit. All of these things are kind of indirect subsidies, but I think ones that would minimize the burden on taxpayers.
I know your original goal was to bring individual units to market for around $300,000, and I'm sure that would adjust with inflation over time. Do you still think that figure is attainable after looking at what Singapore does? I know there has been some analysis from the City and County of Honolulu and the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization. Do you still think that 300,000 number is the target?
Well, we've taken a look at the numbers a little bit more closely, and a previous draft of the measure had 300,000 as the target price for all of the units. And since then, we've revised the draft so that 300,000 would be the median price, so that, you know, up to half of the units would be more than 300,000. And that seems to be a little bit more in line with current cost estimates. But that being said, I think that the authority needs to have the direct incentive, and all the players, not just the authority, whether it's the construction company, the, you know, planners, everybody needs to have the incentive to bring the costs in as low as possible. I'm concerned that a lot of the public housing, that the affordable housing that we have today, the incentive is not necessarily to bring in the cost at the lowest possible level, because there are always more subsidies and tax credits that can be received. For these units, since we're expecting that the buyers are going to cover the entire cost of the construction and the development, they do need to be as low as we can feasibly make them.
Last year, this past year's legislative session, there wasn't the full proposal. Your full proposal was not approved, but there was some money allocated to study it further and explore if and how it could be implemented. So now that you have this knowledge from the trip to Singapore, what issues do you want that study to direct its focus towards?
Since we're really starting a program from scratch that has no precedent in the entire United States, I think the study should really cover all the bases. Now, that being said, there are a lot of questions that we get from the general public, from stakeholders, that seem to be particular concerns in this community. So one of which is, well, the 99-year leases, what happens after 99 years? Does the limited lease term make transfers and trades in the secondary market impossible or impracticable? What happens to the tenants or to the owners after the 99 years expires or as the 99-year deadline approaches? Another issue is the financing. How can we structure the incentives in such a way as to bring in the lowest possible costs, whether that's through a competition model, an RFP model, an RFQ model? Another issue is going to be planning. So we're definitely not going to have the quarter-acre lot, the large yard, the three-car garage that has become the norm in suburban neighborhoods. But to what extent can we plan for high density, and how can we do that in a manner that is welcomed by the people of Hawaii and by the neighbors to these developments? We have to look at how people are going to be able, how the state can finance the development of these units, whether it's through a public-private partnership model, whether the state would front the costs. And, you know, there are a lot of these technical details that, you know, people. Another big one is that we get all the time is, where is the infrastructure adequate and where it is not adequate? Can we pay for the infrastructure that's necessary just through the sales of the units themselves, or is a taxpayer subsidy needed? You know, those are just a few of the questions that we get all the time about this proposal. And so I think the study can drill a little bit deeper than what we've been able to do, you know, on our own. We want to get as much public discussion about these concepts as possible, because we're really at that stage right now where we can design the program that could change Hawaii for generations to come, for centuries to come, in a very fundamental way. And it is not as simple as cutting and pasting. And so we need to really get more and more into the weeds. And even these technical details, because the consequences are going to be so large, I think it's important that there be as much public consultation as possible.
Anything we haven't covered that you'd like to get out there or like to discuss?
So I think we talked a little bit about the urban planning models that they have in Singapore and Hong Kong. And just to elaborate on that a little further, we do have these communities today in Hawaii, like Chinatown, like Waikiki, where you really don't need a car, where it's incredibly convenient and walkable, that within just a few minutes walk of your home, you will have access to grocery stores, to pharmacies, post office, banks, doctors, everything that you would need in your life without ever having to jump into a car or paying for parking or sitting in traffic. And it's not just Hawaii. If you look at Singapore, if you look at Hong Kong, if you look at the Latin Quarter of Paris, if you look at Greenwich Village in New York, the north end of Boston, many, if not most, of the world's most successful neighborhoods have this model of high density, highly convenient, highly walkable neighborhoods. And I think one of the real benefits of employing this public service, this public housing model, is that we're going to be able to focus our communities in such a way that we are going to have not just really high quality of life, but also lower carbon emissions, because we're not going to be emphasizing car transportation. It's going to get people healthier because they'll be walking much more in their communities. Indeed, Hong Kong has the world's longest life expectancy today. And I think it's going to transform the way that future generations grow up. Now, at the same time, we've seen in Hong Kong and Singapore where there can be very robust public housing and the private sector coexisting side by side, where everyone wins. In Singapore, in Hong Kong, you have private sector developers, some of which we toured, that offer very, very high-end housing, and they are able to make a profit, and they are able to have a clientele that is willing to, you know, pay the market prices in the private market, but there is also a public option. So it would be like an education system where there was only private school, and we're trying to introduce public school now. And public school and private school can coexist. And that's what we're trying to achieve with our public housing model. If we do nothing, I really fear that we are going to develop the issues that we saw in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong today, an estimated 200,000 people live in extremely substandard, illegally subdivided, rooftop, even cage or so-called coffin homes, which are no larger than a dog kennel. And for all of these substandard units, we're talking about units that are even smaller, just about as large as a cot, much smaller than a jail cell. What was really eye-opening when we visited these homes in Hong Kong was that this is the ghost of Christmas future for Hawaii. It is very possible that we too will have thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of people living in those extremely inadequate conditions if we do nothing. And I am not okay with that, which is why I think that this has to be at the top priority, the top level of urgency for our policymakers today.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye out for your proposal in next year's legislative session. Hawaii State Senator Stanley Chang, thanks for the time today.
Thank you.
And Hawaii State Senator Stanley Chang just back from an East Asian road trip, talking to Ryan Finnerty there. Senator Chang wants to develop a public housing model for Hawaii based on Singapore's successful program. You can find all our reporting on his idea, including a story that aired on Marketplace, at hawaiipublicradio.org. In 2017, a nonprofit drug and alcohol rehab facility told the state attorney general's office it would make some changes. That followed a report by an independent consultant which identified a number of issues at the Sand Island Treatment Center, which largely relies on public money. So 2 years later, how's it going? That's the topic of a piece today from our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat and investigations editor John Hill, who joins us with more. So, John, 2 years later, what'd you find?
I found that it wasn't until very recently that this drug and alcohol rehab made the changes that the AG had requested, and that only, or not requested, but required. And that only happened after Civil Beat did an investigation touching on many of the same subjects, and the AG checked back in again with the rehab to see if they had done all these things and found that for the most part they had not.
And that includes cutting, I mean, one of the headlines out of this, the annual pay of the executive director there, which topped out at $500,000 for anybody working in a nonprofit. That's an eye-popping figure. But also the reason being that he had intended to pay but got distracted.
That's apparently, and I don't have all the documents in this case. What I do have is the letter that the AG's office sent the rehab, and sort of reading between the lines, that's what happened, that they asked why he had not paid back. They call it a clawback when they require somebody who's been paid excessively to give back some of the money, and he did not do that until the AG contacted him recently after we ran our story. And the explanation apparently was, yes, that he had been had meant to do it all along but was distracted.
And there are other sort of flags along the way here, and I know that you folks have looked at this story before, but for example, in terms of nonprofit boards and the composition of the board, whether that's having outside people, best practices certainly have not been adhered to in this case.
Yes. What our earlier investigation found in April was that two members of the board were the executive director, Mason Henderson, and also one of the top employees of the Drug Treatment Center. And what nonprofit guidelines say is that you shouldn't have too many paid employees on the board because there could be a conflict of interest, and you can imagine how that would occur. And in fact, one of the most accepted nonprofit guidelines we looked at said you shouldn't have more than one, and they had two out of six.
And I realized that you had asked to try to reach a board members who were not available or willing to comment on this. But the idea of sort of what does come next with this, I guess, for the organization itself and also for the investigation of this.
Well, now the AG says after this 2 years when a lot of the stuff was not done that they had required, that they're now going to take a much more aggressive approach, and they're going to take formal legal action if the requirements are not met. It's kind of interesting because this drug rehab is considered kind of essential, I guess, to the city's and to the state's treatment network, so much so that the city of Honolulu recently decided to buy a new place for them for $9 million. That's because they're kind of in the shadow of the Sand Island Wastewater Treatment Plant, and that plant is expanding. They've been operating there since the 1960s without paying rent, and because they have to move, the city of Honolulu has now paid $9 million for a new home for them. So they are considered essential. They have a 2-year program for really hard cases of drug and alcohol addiction. And so now it's an interesting situation where they're going to continue providing that treatment, but now the AG will be taking a much closer look at what they're doing.
And all of this, as you point out, in the context of a city and county and a state, certainly, that is very short on treatment programs as well. John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was investigations editor John Hill with today's reality check. You can read that full story at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ko'olau Women's Healthcare, with offices in Kailua and Honolulu, featuring single-incision laparoscopy. Learn more at ko'olauwomenshealthcare.com.
Coming Saturday, June 29th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's an evening of guitar-forward folk, Americana, and blues music from Tuality, featuring Maui guitar maker Steve Grimes. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
You've been talking about the things I do.
For today's backyard quiz, we were looking for the traditional Hawaiian name for the small east side islet most commonly known as Rabbit Island. While the tiny islet once boasted a population of domesticated rabbits thanks to the efforts of businessman and politician John Adams Cummins, these days you're far more likely to find a series of rare and endangered seabirds, wedge-tailed shearwaters, sooty terns, and brown noddies, just some of the seafaring birds that occupy Rabbit Island, known by its Hawaiian name as manana, meaning buoyant. And while Rabbit Island may be a stone's throw from the sandy beaches of Makapu'u, access to the island and its wildlife strictly forbidden by the Department of Land and Natural Resources. David Dinsmore knew that. He lives on the windward side, and he is today's quiz winner. If you have an idea for a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. When people in Hawaii talk about homelessness, the focus is often on Oahu. That's the island with the largest homeless population by far. But this is an issue that stretches across the islands, and that includes Hawaii Island, where residents and county officials are working on solutions. HPR contributing reporter Sherry Bracken joins us with an update. Sherry, aloha. You've been spending some time looking at this, including a recent community meeting on the west side.
Yes, I have. And the community meeting was really interesting. A business owner named Nakoa Pabre, who owns Umeke's restaurant, got to the point of extreme frustration and had a first sort of informal, small meeting. And then it was followed up about a week ago with a Monday night meeting at his restaurant in Kona's old industrial area to bring together people from the community, including elected officials and police, and just business owners to talk about, are there solutions to the homeless problem? Because the folks in downtown Kailua Village, along Ali'i Drive, and in Kona's old industrial are definitely seeing homeless individuals, and they are causing problems for the businesses.
And what out of that meeting was there a sense of, I don't know, direction or next steps or possible solutions?
Well, I'd like to tell you we've solved all the problems, yeah, but clearly that is not the case. The number of homeless people per the point in time count, which happens every January and figures are released in May, that says there are fewer homeless people on the Big Island, but I'd say that people are not convinced that's true. One of the people at the meeting, a woman named Regina Weller, who had helped battle homelessness in Venice Beach, California, and is a relatively new resident to the Big Island, stood up and asked the question that everybody was asking. If we only have 150 approximate designated homeless people in Kailua Village, why are we allowing them to hold hostage all of the businesses and all of the residents, where it is beginning in the minds of the people who live here, it is beginning to affect tourism, where tourists are a little nervous about being downtown, and why is it affecting business people who have to provide extra security and do cleanup of things they shouldn't have to be cleaning up? So she asked that question, and she's now started a nonprofit here on the Big Island to try to begin to address it, trying to use, in her mind, the model that was used in Venice Beach, which is a coalition of folks who go out, talk to the homeless people. Either you go into shelter or you don't, and if you don't, we get tough, although there's been no definition of what getting tough means, including from Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim, who has said more or less the same thing, that he wants to get tough. So So I'd like to tell you the meeting had solutions, but what it did do was get people talking more about it and making clear to county officials that this problem really is not just an annoyance, it's business affecting and tourism affecting.
You know, that idea of outreach to the individuals involved, and this depends a lot in terms of capacity of whether that's social service areas, whether that's nonprofits, whether that's people who are available to go out and deal with people on an individual basis rather than sort of a blanket term of homelessness generally. I mean, that has been found to be effective in certain communities. But again, I guess the question comes back on this to capacity of what is there in combination of people able to do that.
Well, Hope Services here on the Big Island is the primary service provider, and they have homeless shelters in East Hawaii and in West Hawaii. And they do, in fact, what you're talking about, they do get to know these individuals as individuals, try to find out what their needs are. But the problem is, and Brandy Menino, who's the head of Hope Services, has said this, if you do a sweep and you move homeless people away, they do not disappear. They just pop up someplace else. And that seems to be, we haven't done on this by Big Island, we haven't done too many sweeps, although the mayor started and has done one in Kona at the corner of Polani Road and Queen Kalamono Highway, and then one down at Mo'oheo Bandstand. And yes, it does move people out of that area, and it does clean up that area. But because we don't have any additional shelter capacity, it doesn't really do anything to change the situation. And that's the problem until we get more homeless shelters built.
Meanwhile, there has been discussion and start of Ohana Zone projects, so-called. I know the mayor's office has been working with some state money in that direction.
Absolutely, and that's a good thing. Sharon Hirota, who is with Hawaii County Mayor Kim's office, said that the county has received $4 million to do Ohana Zones, and each island is free to interpret Ohana Zones as they wish. Here on the island, it's going to mean converting the old Hilo Hospital into a 50-bed shelter for men, and I believe it'll be a shelter where they can stay for about 90 days. And then on the west side of the island, it's allowing Hope Services to create a family assessment center because there's no real family shelter here. There's no real way to assess families for what their needs are. So that's going to happen at what's called the Homes at Uluvini, which is an existing shelter that provides emergency, transitional, and longer-term affordable housing. And then the second thing is the county is going to build what has been referred to commonly as Village 9, which is pretty much across from Kealakehe High School. And the phase one of that is going to be tiny homes with shared bathrooms and shared kitchen facilities. And the first phase will provide housing for 30 individuals who will probably be men.
And what's the rough timeline on that?
Well, the word is that these projects will both be completed, at least the first phase, this year, and it's already late June, so hopefully within 6 months. But for most people here, business people and tourists, it just can't come too soon. And that said, that will only deal with people who are willing to go into those shelters, and it doesn't deal with those people who are mentally unstable, drug users, or just unwilling.
You know, you mentioned capacity before in the context of shelter space, but also, as you mentioned, mental health in many cases. Capacity is an issue there as well.
It is a huge issue because we do not have a drug treatment center that you can go into immediately here on the Big Island. As Brandy Menino said the other night, they found a guy who said, yes, I want drug treatment, but that means they have to find a space on Oahu. They have to get him on the plane over to Oahu and make sure he makes it there. And it's just a fairly impractical situation. Now, I will tell you, I'm going to have a conversation within the next few weeks with Dr. Hannon Preston Pita, who is with Big Island Substance Abuse Council, and it might be Dr. Hannah Pita Preston. I could have her names reversed. But she's been heading up BISAC for a few years now, and she has some absolute plans, and I don't know what they are yet because I haven't had the conversation, but we are, Brandy Menino from Hope Services and Dr. Hannah and I will be talking to find out how BISAC plans to go forward, because they are the main drug rehab provider on this island. But as they acknowledge, we need a residential shelter here for that kind of problem.
We've been talking a lot about the west side of the Big Island. Hilo side, you've also recently been over there in terms of looking at their homeless situation.
Yeah, and what I've been talking about is pretty universal, but interestingly, Brandy Menino said the number of unsheltered individuals in downtown areas, Hilo and Kona, is pretty much the same, but she gets many, many more complaints from the Kona side, and I think it's because people are more out in the open. Both Sharon Hirota and Brandy Menino said that in Hilo, there's a couple situations. One, there's a lot more underbrush where people can sort of build their little camps and not be as visible. And number two, there's a private landowner right near downtown who is claiming Hawaiian homeland sovereignty and has allowed homeless people to set up tarps and camps there. And that's sort of moved some of the folks out of the visible eye, but they're still visible if you're in that area.
Sherry Bracken, appreciate that. Sherry Bracken, our contributing reporter from Hawaii Island. Mahalo and aloha.
Aloha, Bill.
That is the program for today. Coming up tomorrow, Honolulu's hosting mayors from across the country. Catherine Cruz is going to bring us an update. And as the G20 meetings get underway in Japan, how are trade tensions hitting shipping here in the islands? We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, go to the conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.